Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the May 19th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is No Parking Zone, The Perils of Finding a Spot in New York City, by Zach Helfand. Annals of Transportation, No Parking Zone, The Perils of Finding a Spot in New York City. Why do city drivers waste 200 million hours a year circling the block? By Zach Helfand. One of the first jobs that George Bickelshave had in America was securing some street parking spaces in the Bronx for Con Edison at $10 an hour. Bickelshavansky, who is from Tbilisi, Georgia, didn't understand why anyone would pay him for this. You just take up four spots of parking and sit there until they tell you to leave, he said. But a job was a job. On the morning of November 18, 2022, Bichlavansky pulled a blue Chrysler minivan onto St. Teresa Avenue in Pelham Bay. As directed, he parked atop a Con Ed manhole, set out on some orange cones, and settled in. He wore a safety helmet and a neon work vest. The morning was beautiful. He watched the sunrise in the rearview mirror. Winter was creeping in. His breath fogged up the glass. Bichlavansky was 29, an outgoing guy with a bright optimism. He'd moved to New York because he was determined to live an interesting life. In Tbilisi, he danced in the Tsvetaeva National Ballet, Georgia's most prestigious troupe. He loved Americans, in part because of Kobe Bryant. He loved New York because of the TV show Suits. He told himself that in this country, he could do anything. In the minivan, he passed the day making video calls to Tbilisi. He used the bathroom and a bodega. He is an eager conversationalist, but sitting in the car sapped his desire to do anything, so he mostly scrolled his phone. A supervisor had told him that Con Ed needed him to block off several parking spaces and the manhole so that some repairs could be made. No one told him when the work crew might come. Night fell and he dozed off. He woke up every 4 hours to upload a photo in an app, as he'd been instructed, confirming his location, and to turn on the heat for a bit. There was a frost. By sunrise, he was wearing leggings, two pair of pants, two shirts, a hat, and two jackets, which was every item of warm clothing he had with him. In the morning, he walked around the corner to a Planet Fitness to shower and brush his teeth. He got coffee and cigarettes at the bodega. He called Tbilisi. He sat and scrolled. He put all of his clothes on before going to bed. He woke up every 4 hours. The next day he passed in the same way, as did the one after that. A malaise set in. He lost track of the days. He spent his first Thanksgiving in the parking spot. He didn't notice. Christmas decorations went up. New York's problem is that it doesn't have enough parking, and it has too much parking. If you arranged all the curbside spots single file, the line would reach Australia. Yet nobody can find a spot. At any time, about half the cars driving in Park Slope are just circling, waiting for someone to leave. It's not unheard of for parkers to stray so far from home that they come back on a bus or in a cab. Drivers naturally tend to advocate for more parking. This runs into problems of geometry. A city with ample parking is eventually no longer a city. To offer as many spaces per capita as Los Angeles County, you'd need a garage the size of Manhattan, 10 stories high. Unlike the bodega bag or admission to the Metropolitan Museum, parking with enough wiles and time can still be had for free. There are some 3 million street spots. 97% cost nothing. The domain of one of New York's weirdest institutions, alternate side parking. The real estate alone, the same as 13 Central Parks, is worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Every day, it's the world's biggest land rush. This produces strange behaviors. The director, Noah Baumbach, who grew up in Park Slope, used parking as a metaphor for entitlement, grievance, and impotence in his films, The Squid and the Whale, and the Meyerowitz stories. The experience of looking for a spot makes you think that you're the only person who hasn't got one. In Bananas, Woody Allen had a dream in which he nailed in which he is nailed to a cross and carried by hooded figures into a parking spot, where the cortege gets into a brawl with another group of hooded figures carrying another crucified man who also want the space. Even when you've got the spot, you're stuck. The rhythms of the curb are governed by Byzantine alternate side rules. Most blocks have signs indicating that for a 90-minute period on different days of the week, the cars on one side of the street must clear out to allow the street sweeper to go by. During that window, cars are supposed to vacate their blocks and park elsewhere. In practice, most people end up sitting in their cars and waiting until the sweeper appears, at which point they quickly double park on the opposite side so they can reclaim their spot in a mad dash once the street has been cleaned. In New York, more people take part in this ritual than attend church. A few hundred thousand city dwellers pay to keep their cars in garages, but the monthly costs in Manhattan usually start at $450. To be a street parker, you need a scrappiness and a certain finesse. Mother Teresa, who ran an AIDS hospice in the West Village in the 1980s, once dropped in at Gracie Mansion unannounced to persuade Ed Koch to give her two reserved spaces. Drivers build lives around parking. The work shifts altered to align with the alternate side rotation hours. The keys always in the pocket, the Pavlovian alertness to the chirp of an unlocking car. A friend who no longer parks in the city told me that when he encounters a vacant spot, he experiences a kind of phantom limb pain. Parking can weasel its way into any conversation. When Rudy Giuliani spoke after the September 11th attacks, he included the announcement, "Alternate side street parking is suspended." Once parkers move in, they're difficult to dislodge. During the pandemic, the city reappropriated 8,500 spots for outdoor dining sheds. Drivers had only recently adjusted to the loss of the thousands of spots given over to city bike kiosks. Initially, this caused a re-examination. People noticed that parking was the thing preventing new bus lanes, bike lanes, rat-proof trash bins, flood mitigation gardens, drop-off zones, and pedestrian plazas. Henry Graeber, whose 2023 book, Pave Paradise, argued that an overabundance of street parking has decimated cities and driven up rents, told me, "When I started writing the book, I said, wouldn't it be great if people could realize how much value is locked up in the curb? And then it actually happened. The next thing that happened was the pandemic's car boom, which made parking even scarcer. Sam Schwartz, a former NYC traffic commissioner, recommended eliminating three parking spaces near a hospital in Washington Heights because ambulances were getting stuck in jams. "You would have thought I was seizing the firstborn of people in that community," he told me. The spots remained. Last year, the outdoor dining sheds came down and the parkers pulled back in. The unusual vehemence of city parkers could have something to do with the fact that circling for a spot produces a hormonal response similar to being at war. Every year in New York, people are bludgeoned, shot, or killed over parking spaces. Aggression arises from desperation and from violations of unwritten codes. In 2018, a pedestrian was holding a spot for a family member when another driver swooped in. The police arrived after the losing parker apparently punched the victor in the face. The alleged puncher was Alec Baldwin. Baldwin claims it was a light push. This incident proved that you can have the resources of a garage guy and the disposition of a street guy. I've got every fucking numbnuts asshole in the world writing to me online going, "You don't have a garage," he said afterward. "I have a parking garage down the block, actually." On St. Teresa Avenue, George Bixwaldley learned that in order to maintain friendly relations, he had to share his spots. He let neighbors move his cones and park, provided they left their phone numbers and moved when called. One family asked Bixwaldley to make his spaces available during a birthday party. He agreed. They invited him to join, but he wasn't in a party mood. One day, a Con Ed truck finally showed up. Bixwaldley moved the minivan. man and the workers opened the manhole. He asked them, "Today we're closed? The job is finished?" The crew said he had to stay. Around day 20, he woke up with a toothache. It became difficult to sleep. A darkness set in. "I had a bad feeling for life," he said. It can take years to learn the rules and cadences of a neighborhood. Parking customs function like accents. It's easy to identify the interlopers. People in the Rockaways are friendly to neighbors, but shun outsiders. In Chelsea, drivers used to double park on the opposite side and await the sweeper, but now they don't move until the sweeper honks at them. The development, common around the city, may demonstrate pandemic-related behavioral shifts or perhaps the breakdown of our social fabric. Levels of courtesy, aggression, and entitlement vary. There are blocks of Brooklyn Heights where people sit in their cars but never move at all, even when the sweeper arrives. All New Yorkers think that their neighborhood is the worst, though some are less bad. Over a three-year stretch, 300,000 cars were towed or booted citywide for parking illegally, but zero in Staten Island. In Ridgewood, Queens, I met an Eastern European Uber driver who said he often slept in his car in order to pounce on early spots. "Parking here, it's the ass," he told me. On a block in Southern Ozone Park, one man had 19 cars that he moved back and forth. There are double parkers who stay in the car, double parkers who leave, and double parkers who put a note on the dash displaying their phone number in case someone needs them to move. In Mott Haven, in the South Bronx, cars double park long term. "People honk for hours and nobody comes," a woman named Liz told me from her Honda Pilot. In Greenwich Village, near Fifth Avenue, cars move for the sweeper in an elegant, coordinated undulation. "It's like the wave at Citi Field," John Bianchi, an editor at a PR agency and a musician who has been parking in the area for 25 years, told me. "Reparking is like the closing of a zipper. There are complicated crowd dynamics. You have to have a chess mentality," Bianchi told me. "You need to think two or three moves ahead. Some people have a checkers mentality, and it screws everything up completely." Bianchi compared the maneuver to an oral tradition passed down through generations. The Homer of Fifth Avenue was a local building super he'd nicknamed the Mayor of Parking because of how he supervised the alternate side dance and generally ensured orderly conduct, such as maintaining proper spacing between cars. 18 inches is considered both respectful and efficient. It's just enough for the garbage men to get through. There are universal rules. Parking sharks, poachers who trail the sweeper in order to slip into vacated spaces, are handled through mob justice. Reversing into a spot is regarded as proper. One parker told me, headfirst is barbaric. Bianchi once found himself in a Seinfeldian standoff in front of his apartment. He backing in, his rival pulling in. "I said, I can stay here all night," he recalled. "She said, I can stay here all night." So I left the car, turned it off, and went upstairs, and I sat by the window reading a book until she gave up. Asking about someone's preferred parking spot is like asking to see their tax return. People clam up. There are a couple of blocks with a 30-minute alternate side window rather than the usual 90. The parkers arbitrage. Some people know alternate side blocks where the sweeper never comes, which means, as Bianchi put it, "We have actually formally created a law in which New Yorkers have to be in a certain place at a certain time for no fucking reason at all." Enterprising parkers have found workarounds. A guy named Carmine used to hang out at a social club in Little Italy, move cars as a side gig. One woman paid him $100 a month. The biggest tension was he would always find a spot by his house, which was like 2.5 blocks away from mine, she told me. Mostly people sit in their cars and find ways to fill the time. The nappers, Bible studiers, book readers. Mary Norris, an author and a former copy editor at The New Yorker, wrote a blog called The Alternate Side Parking Reader. Jim Downey, a longtime head writer for Saturday Night Live, thought of bits. His car jokes include O.J. Simpson gags for Norm MacDonald's Weekend Update and lines for Stefan, the Bill Hader character. In a parking space, the juices flow. You're in this little cocoon, Downey told me. People aren't bugging you. These days, people do therapy sessions or take work calls or video meetings. Where else in a city of 8 million do we get such solitude? Bianchi likes to make music. The ukulele is easy because it fits behind the wheel, he said. Parking problems begin, more or less, with the first vehicles. In 750 BC, the Assyrian king Sennacherib prohibited chariot parking on royal roads. Violators could be beheaded. One of New York's first parking panics came in the 1920s. Young couples, having discovered that cars were a nice private place for making out, began parking wherever passion called. At night, 50 or 60 automobiles would clog King's Highway in Brooklyn. Another popular spot was Lookout Hill in Prospect Park. The police staged periodic raids. After one, the Brooklyn Eagle wrote, "And so the petters, like the gypsies, must move on again, a wandering tribe with every hand against them." But to where? City designers at the time were lining streets with little parks. These became filled up with cars. We replaced parks with parking. In the first decade of the automobile age, New York banned parking for longer than a few hours. The prohibition was irregularly followed. The NYPD would just drive the illegally parked cars to the police station. A later proposal suggested letting the air out of violators' tires. The other day, I visited Parking Court. Manhattan's Parking Violations Bureau is housed in an office building downtown. The vast majority of defendants argue their cases online. Generally, the best defense is not to argue circumstances or evidence, but to find an error on the ticket. A handful show up in person. The bureau looks like a DMV with a counter for checking in. The head judge, Marion Morris, talked affably with me. She asked what my neighborhood does when the sweeper comes. I told her that everyone double parks. She winced. There are parking defense attorneys, but not many. The penalty for ignoring alternate side rules and blocking the sweeper is just $65, which is what a few hours in Midtown garage goes for. The city tows, too, but usually only cars with unpaid fines. Larry Berezin got into parking after he retired as a personal injury lawyer. "People I beat parking tickets for were more grateful than people I beat criminal charges for," he told me. In 2018, the city created a new position, the Parking Summons Advocate, whose office is in the Parking Violations Bureau. The current advocate is Anthony C., a friendly man who grew up in Bensonhurst, where his father scrapped for alternate side parking. Now C. lives in downtown Brooklyn and pays for a garage. His office instructs drivers on how to prepare evidence for their hearings. It helps if photos and videos are time-stamped and show a street sign, and in obviously losing cases, educates people on the rules. He also assists a lot of people who were parked in a legal spot only to be towed by utility workers or film crews to an illegal spot where they were often ticketed. As a mayor, Fiorella LaGuardia once sat as a parking magistrate for a day. He stayed for 5 hours, heard 197 cases, and left in a police car that had been stationed next to a no parking sign. Under Giuliani, the Parking Violations Bureau was transferred to the Department of Finance. Dennis Boschnack, a former parking judge who now contests parking tickets for clients, told me that this creates an unavoidable conflict of interest. The Department of Finance, their mission is to collect money for the city, he said. Judges can see a case every couple of minutes. Parking Court was empty when I arrived. A few defendants trickled in. A FedEx driver showed up with 10 tickets. A security guard recognized him. "You're a regular," she said. He took off his hat when his hearing began. One woman came in with 2 tickets for using a fraudulent Department of Transportation parking ticket. The permit was legitimate, it turned out. Each hearing room is a small office. A judge sits at a desk with a computer. The respondent sits in a chair. I watched one case involving a guy who lived on West 48th Street. He had 6 tickets on his Porsche. The first charge was a street sweeping violation. The judge swore him in. How do you plead? She asked. Not guilty, he told the judge. I was actually in the car fixing my daughter's car seat. C told me that people often don't realize that sitting in the car or double parking for the sweeper isn't a legal defense. Over time, though, parking practices tend to solidify into law. New York ended its overnight parking ban in 1954. The reason cited by the mayor was that no one was following the law anyway. The reversal received modest press coverage. An argument could be made that it ranks among the most consequential decisions the city has ever made. It was also one of the most casual. George Bichlavi didn't know it, but he was part of an entire industry of professional parkers. One consequence of New York legalizing free long-term parking is that much of the city's critical infrastructure is now covered by parked cars. When Con Ed needs to access electric cables or steam lines, it sends someone like Bichlavi, called a parking spotter, to reserve space around the manhole. Spotters work for cable companies, gas utilities, and movie shoots, but Con Eds are everywhere. Each year, the company spends millions of dollars on spotting. This is how New York has decided to keep the lights on. Owing to the unpredictability of the work, it's not unusual for spotters to spend days, weeks, or more living in a parking space. For Con Ed, spotters are an easy solution to a persistent problem. We're as frustrated as anyone is about the difficulty of parking in New York, Jamie McShane, a Con Ed spokesperson, told me. The company farms out the jobs to a big contractor called CE Solutions. CE Solutions passes the work on to an array of subcontractors. The ideal subcontractor is just a guy who knows guys. One subcontractor was a reputed soldier for the Genovese crime family. Another was a reggae musician in Harlem. Subcontractors typically get $21 to $29 per hour of spotting and pay spotters as little as $8. On occasion, subcontractors get sued for failing to comply with New York's overtime and minimum wage laws. Today, the minimum wage is $16.50 an hour. Generally, courts have found that the lawyers of outsourcing insulate Con Ed and CE Solutions from liability. One subcontractor, CE217, accused CE Solutions in lawsuit of using subcontractors in an elaborate shell game to skirt labor laws. A lawyer representing CE Solutions said the allegation is completely false. Bichlavi found the spotting job through a Georgian friend he called Sam. He was renting a room from Sam in Gravesend, Brooklyn. Later, Bichlavi worked for another subcontractor called A&M Transport. One former A&M employee has sued the company, alleging that his supervisor, Medina Shikrova, withheld his pay when his car broke down and he had to leave his spot, telling him that she would make sure he could never get work. In another lawsuit, workers alleged that supervisors controlled their bathroom breaks. When their break requests weren't granted, they sometimes had to use a bucket. Shikorva said that in legal filings that she doesn't have enough information to confirm or deny this. The year the Bichlavi was parked on St. Teresa Avenue, A&M made $8.5 million. New York drivers waste 200 million hours each year circling for parking. This is enough man-hours to build 4 Nimitz-class U.S. Navy aircraft carriers. 20 minutes to find a spot is routine. An hour isn't crazy. Drivers have always complained that parking has never been worse. In the 1920s, the city considered building a 30,000-space lot beneath Central Park. Car ownership keeps going up. Risks have gone down. In 1990, one car was stolen off the street for every 50 residents. Last year, it was 1 in 600. Parking is the city's most visible form of corruption. Roy Cohn got his start fixing his teachers' parking tickets. A kickback scandal at the Parking Violations Bureau almost took down the Koch administration. Eric Adams has used parking as a political favor. As the Brooklyn Borough President, he rewarded staffers with spots in the middle of the pedestrian plaza outside Borough Hall. Adams compared one anonymous critic of his parking regime to a Klansman. Back when diplomats at the UN were immune from paying parking tickets, they often just parked in front of a driveway. The more corrupt a diplomat's home nation, the more brazen the parker. Kuwaitis were the worst offenders. The Canadian delegation went without a violation for 8 years. In the 80s, the city began towing diplomats' cars, and Sam Schwartz, who was then the traffic commissioner, was hauled before the UN. I addressed what I heard was the best attended session of the General Assembly ever, he told me. He recalled that the issue united the Arabs and the Israelis. Every year, the city issues around 100,000 parking permits, called placards, to groups like the police and fire departments, and to people with disabilities. In 2017, Bill de Blasio gave placards to 50,000 teachers and school employees during his re-election campaign. Legally, placards confer limited privileges. You can park in some restricted zones, meters are free, but in practice, they can function as blanket immunity. On the black market, placards go for as much as $2,600. People also counterfeit their own. On cars parked in bus lanes or beside fire hydrants, you can find placards purporting to be from FEMA or the Red Cross, or just pieces of paper listing professions: working press, doctor of podiatric medicine, New York State funeral director's official business. These work surprisingly well. For years, Jan Wenner, the editor and publisher of Rolling Stone, wrangled special press plates for his car, which allowed him to park where most others couldn't. The worst placard abusers are the police, who park on sidewalks, in front of hydrants, and in traffic lanes, bus lanes, and bike lanes. In the past, ticketing agents have been arrested for writing tickets to police officers. In 2011, 11 NYPD officers were charged with fixing more than $100 million worth of parking tickets. Patrick Lynch, the head of the police union at the time, said that the practice has been accepted at all ranks for decades. On the Upper West Side, officers of the 20th Precinct double-parked their personal cars in the middle of Columbus Avenue. Cops get free subway and bus rides, but the precinct's traffic sergeant argued that the parkers had no choice. I can't tell all the officers they need to take mass transit, he said. I recently met up with Gersh Kuntzman, the editor of the transportation website Streets Blog. Kuntzman hunts for traffic cheats, placard scofflaws, license plate defacers. People altered their plates to escape detection on tow cameras. We wandered Brooklyn Heights to check out some parked cars. Kuntzman rode a bike that had a big parking placard on it. I'm a chaplain, he said. As a part of an investigation, he had paid $750 to something called the New York State Chaplain Group, which gave him a scam placard and a badge. The first block we looked at was anarchy, placard cheats, meter skippers. On the dashboard of one car was a neon MTA work vest. He's an MTA employee, Kuntzman said. Why he's driving to work? Because he's an asshole. He noticed that it had out-of-state plates. Oh, he's a Jersey asshole. We talked about parking over eggs at a nearby diner. The question is not, why is it too hard to park, he said. It's, why is it so easy to own a car in the city with the most congestion in the world? Kuntzman thinks that street parking should be mostly banned, and when available, very expensive. Charging for parking was essentially the life's work of Donald Shoup, a professor at UCLA and the country's foremost parking scholar. Shoup died in February. His autobiography in the Wall Street Journal said, "The magnitude of his influence has been likened to that of Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs. Moses happened to oppose street parking on national security grounds. If the Soviets bombed, the congestion would be deadly." The journal continued, "He's also been compared to, in seriousness, by serious people, to Pythagoras, Cezanne, and Einstein." Shoup calculated that the country dedicated more space to parking each car than to housing each human. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. His insight was that free parking is not actually free. We spend as much on off-street parking via things like taxes, higher rents, and subsidies as we spend on Medicare. Shoup's proposed solution was to charge enough that there's always an open space or two on every block. The payments could be made up in a number of ways: dynamically priced meters, residential parking permits. In Europe, cars come equipped with sensors that detect when you're in a parking space and allow you to pay automatically, sort of like a parking easy pass. In Manhattan, of course, the market price might be obscenely high, probably not much less than a monthly garage. He sounds like an enlightened individual, Mary Norris told me of Shoup, but he was my archenemy. If priced right, on the other hand, Shoup's proposal could eliminate the time wasted on spot hunting. I've sometimes asked what I do in my spare time. I park. For years, I lived in Cobble Hill, where the alternate side custom is to double park but remain in the car, which I think of as responsible yet expedient. While I wait for the sweeper, I eat breakfast in the car. I look at the birds. It's a nice time to think. Occasionally, as we all wait, someone drives onto the block and pulls into a space on the vacated side. Now it's musical chairs. Everyone scrambles back across the street, and one person loses. I call this the stampede. At home, I spend a lot of time looking out the window to watch for cars leaving. If you catch it right, you can sometimes move your car back and forth in such a way that you avoid the alternate side wait for the week. Recently, I moved to Brooklyn Heights, which, despite being only a 10-minute walk away, is inscrutable to me. My street inexplicably has a 10-hour alternate side window instead of the usual 90 minutes, which requires a sit and wait in the morning and in the evening. I did it a few times and then gave up and went back to my old block. To this, Kuntzman said, look at how much mental capacity you need to be able to figure this out. The odd thing is, I told him, is that I hardly use the car. I drive it occasionally to leave the city, but almost never within the city. In New York, only a small fraction of car owners drive to work. To city residents, the car is mostly a pleasure vehicle, or in theory, at least, a convenience. This paradoxically binds us to the parking spot more than to the car. The dynamic is found almost nowhere else except maybe Boston, where Henry Graeber, the author, discovered a woman who was so afraid of losing her spot that she wouldn't drive to the supermarket and had consequently lost 11 pounds. Kuntzman threw up his hands. They sold you on a car, a symbol of the American freedom, he said, and you're shackled. When I'm looking for a parking space, I turn into a monster. One popular anger management book advises drivers, enraged at a rival stealing their spot, to pretend that the space was taken by something without malicious intent, like a cow. I've only once considered keying someone's car. Usually I just scream. One time, as the sweeper went by, a woman in an SUV darted into my vacated space. I opened the window and yelled, "You can't do that!" It turned out that there was room enough for two cars, and she was just pulling forward out of my way. Moo. Parking is one of the most consistent sources of stress in my life. When I'm parking, the radio gets switched off. Conversation stops. And yet the euphoria of finding a spot is somehow worth it. I'd compare the tension, shock, and release to those videos in which a soldier has a surprise reunion with a loved one. On familiar turf, I'm a good parker. The Guinness World Record for tightest parallel park is 2.9 inches of clearance performed by a stunt driver in a Fiat 500. Most street parkers I know, myself included, are convinced that they've done tighter. Like fishermen, we have our trophies. Mine was on Congress Street, where after 45 minutes of circling, I once launched a 30-point assault on a spot I dismissed several times earlier. I made it in. You could have fit a couple of pieces of paper on either side of my bumper. On the Upper West Side, I've been told, this is referred to as cracking the matzah. This was before the backup camera, which ruined the sport of it, like baseball in the live ball era. Several people have told me that it makes them sad to contemplate how their years of parking knowledge will disappear when they die. There's a Talmudic reading of the alternate side calendar, with its We Are the World assemblage of holidays. To celebrate the solemnity of the Ascension, Eid al-Adha, the Tish B'Av, a day of fasting that commemorates various Jewish disasters, nobody has to move their car. Some years, with enough planning, you can string together several holidays in a row. It's like drawing a straight flush, Jim Downey, the Saturday Night Live writer, said. He once planned a vacation around a two-week holiday string, then came back to find he'd been towed by a crew shooting Law and Order to a non-holiday spot. This year, the calendar added Losar, the Tibetan Buddhist New Year. Ben Furness, the executive director of the street reform nonprofit Transportation Alternatives, is a free parking skeptic, but nevertheless told me of the calendar. It brings tears to my eyes. It's one of the most beautiful illustrations of multiculturalism anywhere in the world. It's just deeply hilarious that it's associated with having to move your car on a certain day. It sort of shows the ad hoc, historically contingent way in which we found ourselves here. Parking is a way of seeing the world. I can tell you where every fire hydrant is in my neighborhood. I drive down the streets in the same way each time, in ever-widening circles, a route I've refined over the years. Drew Velke, a neuroscientist who has studied hunting strategies across species, identified two main ones in parkers. We call it soaring versus perching, he said. Eagles will get into these flight patterns where they're soaring over the landscape and more actively searching. Owls and falcons will sit on a branch and wait for the food to come by. Velke said that New York City, resource scarce, competition heavy, rewards a third strategy, a ritualized hunting route. We're cheetahs, essentially. One parker spoke of marital tensions arising from irreconcilable parking differences. One is a circler, one is a waiter. One night, as George Bickenshalvey slept in the minivan, the temperature dropped. He shivered in his two jackets. He couldn't sleep. Sometimes a little bit I cried, he said. The work crew came again and left again. His tooth ached. He video chatted with a friend celebrating a birthday. I had a beer and three shots of whiskey, he told me. It was not good. After a while, another Con Ed parking spotter showed up, a woman living in a Mercedes, which she parked over another manhole. She was a model and an aspiring influencer. They began talking. The guys in the bodega took a liking to him. They let him pay a little less for cigarettes. He told himself, I've got a fighting spirit for my life goals. He channeled Kobe Bryant. On day 33, the work crew came again. This time he was exasperated. He implored, when will this end? The average street sweeper collects 1,500 pounds of debris every day. We pick up rats, pigeons, Antonio Tallarico, who has driven a street sweeper for 19 years, told me on a recent morning. He was on 72nd in Amsterdam with his supervisor, John Piazza. His shift was about to begin. The Department of Sanitation calls this district Manhattan 7. The sweeper comes here twice a week on each side. Different neighborhoods are swept at different frequencies. This is determined in part by a cleanliness rating calculated by sanitation and in part by community request. Certain areas tend to cooperate better than others, Tallarico said. We find that the Upper West Side is generally a problem. Piazza nodded his head at Tallarico. His brother used to sweep in this district and then left, he said. It's frustrating every day. You don't want to take that home to your family. The sanitation department used to slap neon stickers on the windows of cars that didn't move for the sweeper as a shaming tactic, but the city council forced them to stop. I believe it was deemed like cruel and unusual punishment, Tallarico said. Tallarico, who wore a green sanitation hoodie and driving gloves, hopped up in the cab. I got in a jump seat. He used a few dials to control the broom speed and the pressure. At one point, we squeezed past a double parked car with a few inches on either side. "That's all experience, my friend," he said. "I can do this route with my eyes closed." Basically, no cars moved until we were right behind them, honking. Piazza's job was to drive another car, leading the sweeper and cajoling drivers sitting in parked cars to move out of the way, ticketing non-compliers. This buddy system is deployed frequently in problem districts. Sanitation issues about 1 million alternate side parking tickets a year. The NYPD issues 3 million. There's currently a bill in the state senate to outfit the sweepers with cameras that would automatically photograph violators and send out tickets by mail. Their route for the day wound from Riverside Drive to Central Park, mostly in the 80s and 90s. Piazza communicated with Tallarico via walkie-talkie. Trouble began almost immediately. On 19th Street, a woman in a white Subaru blocked the sweeper while she carried items from her building. "But if I tag her, I'm an evil person," Piazza said. There was a woman who'd fallen asleep in her car, a belligerent guy with a dog, a Range Rover driving the wrong way. "He's about to kill someone," Piazza said. Across Columbus, a double parked construction van caused a clog. Piazza yelled up to a worker on some scaffolding. "Yo!" The worker jumped down and moved the van. It took Tallarico 22 minutes to travel 3 blocks. This was 3% of the route. After many years, Piazza can recognize the license plates of serial offenders. He's more lenient with some buildings, a funeral parlor, a school, because the occupants keep the streets clean themselves. He has a good relationship with the doorman along Central Park, who'll run out of a building to move cars for the broom. Piazza told me, "I've had kids in the car alone. Hi, I don't have a license plate. We'll tell your parents. They're getting a ticket." On Central Park West, he honked repeatedly at one oblivious parker. "This guy's picking his ear," he said. The caravan turned onto 89th Street. Piazza got out to tell someone to move. "I've been sitting here in the car. I don't know how to drive it," an older man said. "I've got to write you a ticket," Piazza said. The man said he was helping out a woman who was away. "She set you up for failure," Piazza said. He wrote a ticket. The pair made it through only a fraction of the route. I asked Tallarico what sweeping has taught him. "People are territorial," he said. "It's the lack of courtesy that bothers him, not the parking. He drives to work and parks in the sanitation garage, so he can avoid his own alternate side obligations." Piazza lives in Riverdale and drives to work, too. "I'm never home, so when I am on a day and there's alternate side, I don't think about it. I've gotten tickets. I'm like, all right, I screwed up." On day 33, shortly after George Bickelshelvey's outburst to the work crew, he was notified that the job was closed. He bellowed, "Freedom!" He blasted electronic music and drove straight home. He showered and went to the barber. He had a drink and relaxed. He bought a plane ticket for somewhere warm. He spent New Year's in Miami. Upon returning, with no other options, he picked up more spotting work. He had a shift of 27 days, again in the Bronx. There was a 24-day stint on 149th Street. "Every narco man and every homeless lived on that street, and also me, together," he said. He gave dollars to the homeless. He liked parking in Manhattan better. He had conversations with doormen and dog walkers. During a stint on West End Avenue, he befriended a writer, Daniel Krieger, who photographed him for a short online article. Sometimes people would ask why he was living in a parking spot. One time somebody told me, "America's good, right?" I told them, "Why?" He said, "Because you do nothing and somebody's giving you salary." He found that, despite the job, he did love America. On the flight back from Miami, he felt himself longing for New York. "It was a feeling of coming home," he said. He quit spotting after 9 months. Recently, he joined a lawsuit against CE Solutions, A&M Transport, Shokorova, and others for failure to pay minimum wage and overtime. He's moved on. He reminded himself that he is a world-class dancer and that, in Tbilisi, he'd run 2 small businesses. "I have 2 hands, 2 legs, 2 eyes. I can do everything," he said. "I just need my time." Recently, he has worked as a driver for Access a Ride and Lyft. One perk is that when he's working, he never has to park. by Zach Heflin. Zach Heflin is the staff writer at The New Yorker. A Critic at Large, The Battling Memoirs of The New Yorker. A host of accounts by the magazine staffers covers a full century of its history, but the trove of recollections is fraught and jumbled by Anthony Lane. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Before doing so, however, he sat around with the boys in the bar and thrashed out exactly what he meant to create. The same is true pretty much of Harold Wallace Ross, who begat The New Yorker. Until the first issue was published on February 21st, 1925, the magazine was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Yet the spirit of Ross, aided by his wife and co-begetter, Jane Grant, had been busy. A prospectus for their forthcoming project came out in the fall of 1924. It kicked off with a sturdy pronouncement: The New Yorker will be a reflection in word and picture of metropolitan life. It will be human, as opposed to what? Avian, Venusian, microbial, howlingly lupine? Clearly the plan was to spread the word so that the magazine would be under discussion well before it made an entrance. It would be so attractive, gay, and informative that it would be an asset to any library table. Such were the cheerful hopes of Grant, who seems to have trusted that any future readers would, by definition, have a house with a library. There, the New Yorker would lounge, unfurled, beside the whiskey decanter and the smoldering cigar. Grant's recollections are part of her memoir, Ross, The New Yorker and Me, which was published in 1968. Note that there is no comma, no Oxford comma, that is, beloved of this publication and often scorned elsewhere, before the conjunction. One shudders to think how Ross, whom Grant divorced in 1929 and who died in 1951, would have reacted to so echoing a lack. Ross, The New Yorker and Me is just one in a stack of books about him and about his successor, William Shawn, who as the magazine's editor from 1952 to 1987 was a match for Ross in the fastidious management of a text. The entire stack could be crowned with the heading Fanfare for the Comma Men. The magazine is now 100 years old. Not a bad score, though it falls short of that racked up by the actress Eva Mae Saint, who reached her own centenary last July. What's more, given that The New Yorker played no role in North by Northwest, how much do we really have to crow about? There is no more tempting occasion for the backward glance. What's remarkable is how many glancers there have already been in the course of decades past. Writers, editors, and residents of varying tenures, the nostalgic, the acidic, the disturbingly blithe, those who seek to set the record straight, and those who prefer it kinked, all have, at some point, leafed through what they recall of their spell at The New Yorker and fed the leafings into a book. A list would include, in addition to Grant's book, James Thurber's The Years with Ross from 1957, Brendan Gill's Here at The New Yorker, 1975, About The New Yorker and Me, 1979, and by E.G. Kahn, Jr., plus its blockbuster sequel, Year of Change, More About The New Yorker and Me, 1988, Remembering Mr. Shaw's New Yorker by Ved Mehta, which came out in 1998, as did Lillian Ross's Here But Not Here, Renata Alder's Gone, 1999, A Life of Privilege Mostly, 2003, by Gardner Botsford, Alison Rose's Better Than Sane, 2004, and Let Me Finish, 2006, by Roger Angel, or, as he was credited in his first piece for the magazine in 1944, Corporal Roger Angel, a fine joke, the notion that he was ever of lowly rank. Jane Gross, the receptionist, 2012, brings up the rear in style. Mention should also be made of Avid Reader, 2016, by Robert Gottlieb, who edited The New Yorker from 1987 to 1992. It's true that, of the book's 9 chapters, only one is devoted to the magazine. Far more space is consumed by Gottlieb's labors in the publishing trade, at Simon & Schuster, and at Knopf. Nevertheless, Avid Reader is thus far the only memoir by anyone who has captained the ship at The New Yorker. Neither Harold Ross nor William Shawn wrote a book about being on board. The only piece that bore Shawn's name, or at least his initials, in these pages was The Catastrophe, a cursory fantasy of 1936 in which New York is demolished by a meteorite and consigned to oblivion. Make of that what you will. Even if they had been so inclined, they wouldn't have had the time, so unflagging was their industry on behalf of the magazine. Who wants to pontificate about the place, let alone reminisce, when there's an issue to close? What do we have is a eulogistic fragment of Shawn on Ross, tied like a flag to the end of Brendan Gill's book. It's a loyal and fair-minded tribute to a man who, however eccentric, held fast to the cause of fairness, and who took both pleasure and refuge in the solid ground of facts, infinitely more dependable than the shifting screen of ideas. Ross, Shawn reports, once told me, half seriously, that he didn't want to know what any writer thought. A sound principle, I'd say, bettered only by the specific command that Ross gave an assistant: never leave me alone with poets. Landing at The New Yorker in 1993, I stepped into unknown territory, with only a couple of writers to show me the way. One was Pauline Kael, who I was never to meet, but into whose volumes of movie reviews I had often delved, in fearful reverence, trying not to jab myself on the prickles. The trouble was that Kael's work taught you a hell of a lot about motion pictures, and quite a lot about Kael, but very little about the magazine. My other guide, The Years with Ross, was more instructive, not to say daunting. A man's past dropped away, and his life began anew, when he went to work for The New Yorker, Thurber wrote. Not until then had it occurred to me that West 43rd Street was a tributary of the River Jordan. Thanks to Thurber, I learned that Peter Arno's first caption drawing had appeared in the magazine in the fall of 1925, and that S.J. Perlman and Ogden Nash didn't show up to the party until 5 years later. It was also revealed that Ross's worship of accuracy did not extend to his own spelling. Significance came out significant. One of the other surprise, profane though Ross could be in conversation, his cheek was easily mantled with a blush. He refused to visit Sainte-Chapelle in Paris because stained glass is damned embarrassing. And Thurber once confounded him on his birthday by sending a dozen red roses to the New Yorker offices. When Ross bridled, Thurber threatened to add a card that read, "In everlasting memory of those Riviera nights." To my innocent ears, the whole thing had, and retains, the ring of a classic Thurber fable, true to him, if not to the historical record. Infectious, too, so consistently nonplussed is the author by the basic mechanisms of existence that, if we're not careful, we come to forget what it feels like to be plussed. What I picked up, however, from murmurs, never shouts, at the magazine was an impression that there was something not right about The Years with Ross. Was it warped in its vision of its subject? Awry, perhaps, in not giving credit where it was properly due? I never plumbed that mystery. As late as 2003, it was starting to find Gardner Botsford in the midst of his otherwise temperate memoir about a lengthy stretch as a New Yorker editor, refer in passing to Thurber's terrible book. Order might be restored, I reckoned, by switching to a slightly less distant version of events. I opened Gill's Here at the New Yorker and was buoyed to discover that his arrival at the magazine in 1938 had been as flummoxing as mine. Gremlins had infested the very typewriter by which he was supplied. When one typed an S, it invariably came out a W. This led to a wingular effect on my prow. More baffling was what he called the total absence of any camaraderie in the office. The custom, Gill added, was to speak as little as possible and then as dourly as possible. One never touched another person except by accident. Happily, this was no longer the case in 1993. Not that I skipped down the corridors arm in arm with Joseph Mitchell and Harold Brodkey, but there were no barriers to free speech. The indestructible Gill, still strolling the fairways of the magazine, was more than welcoming to a greenhorn. Yet this book proved to be no more tolerable than Thurber's. There was something even wronger about it, to judge from a biting review in Esquire by Nora Ephron, who accused Gill of smug self-congratulation, deriding his anecdotes as condescending, snobbish, and mean. All in all, Ephron declared, here at the New Yorker was one of the most offensive books I have read in a long time. Browsing between the lines, I cunningly worked out that she hadn't liked it very much. Could it be that everyone connected to the New Yorker, not only employees or former employees, but staunch subscribers too, was automatically equipped with an axe to grind? The saga of this allegedly civilized periodical seemed about as tranquil as a Viking smithy. And that's all we have time for today. By Anthony Lane. Anthony Lane is the staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Nobody's Perfect. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.